Maybe you tuned in and saw the first Olympian from the United States win gold in the Pyeongchang Olympics. It took place last Sunday. Now relive this moment with me. NBC's coverage takes us approximately 15 miles north of Pyeongchang to the Bokwang Phoenix Skate Park, where this freestyle skiing, snowboarding, and slopestyle events will be held throughout the Olympics. The coverage has shown select runs of men's slopestyle snowboarding competition, focusing on the front runners, Ståle Sandbeck of Norway, and the Canadians Max Perreault and Mark McMorris. Of the four Olympians from the United States, only 17-year-old Red Girard has looked comfortable on the course, but he too couldn't land one of his jumps on his second run, and he sits in 11th place heading into his final attempt. Before descending onto the course, we see Girard high five and hug three friends, and then we can hear him sigh loudly before he pushes off. He attacks the upper portion of the course with equal parts speed and deference, completing tail slides, tapping the nose of his board on rails, and sailing up and over the hitching post, which has been his signature move throughout each attempt. The lower portion of the course includes three jumps, over which Girard will land an inverted flip 540, a backside 1260, and finally he'll slam down a backside triple cork 1440. That's three flips and a couple twists thrown in just for good measure. At the bottom, he'll purposely slide into the reception area, take off his board, and run to greet friends and family. He'll receive his winning score and then wait out the remaining competitors until none of them have unseated him. NBC's post coverage will include interviews with Girard, in which they'll focus on his accomplishment at such a young age, and they'll show footage of his family's backyard in Silverthorne, Colorado, in which Girard's older siblings cemented rusty handrails partway down the hill on their property. These summer eyesores became crucial to Girard's snowboarding skill during the winter when he practiced daily. In one interview, Girard said, "I've got to thank my brother Malachi for the idea to collect handrails and cement them in the backyard. I'm grateful for all that has led up to this moment." Now a very different moment, one from long, long ago, that followed after 40 days of rain and many more days of waiting. It was after the raven returned to Noah's hand, and it was after the dove returned as well, the first time exhausted, and the second time with a freshly plucked olive leaf. Finally, it's the moment after the dove did not return, when God said to Noah, "Go out of the ark with your family. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on it." So Noah and family disembarked. Now, I've often wondered what thoughts ran through Noah's head as he stood at the door of the ark and prepared to leave it. When he surveyed the scene, what words? Maybe words that he would like to take back escaped from his lips when he saw the devastation. How did he understand what just happened? As he took his first steps onto the soggy ground, the din of animals and family in the background, was he overcome by the deafening silence of a planet whose slate had been wiped clean? Did the loneliness and isolation terrify him? What did he think of the God whose divine power had just caused such chaos? Now, don't tell me Noah was confident of the outcome of his boat-building adventure or that he didn't wonder if at some point God might decide that he and his family were beyond saving too. Don't tell me that Noah didn't take note of the ark's technological advances, just like the technological advances on display when the Tower of Babel was constructed with uniform bricks and mortar instead of bulky stones of varying shapes and sizes. Don't tell me that Noah wasn't tempted to think highly of these accomplishments and to revel in his family's survival. Noah's entire life, as well as the lives of his family members, has led up to this moment. All the ridicule from neighbors, all the problem solving and decisions about construction techniques and how to make sealant. Now the waters are receded, and his family, they find themselves alone. How did they talk about what happened? And what were their thoughts? Unfortunately, we have no indication about their thoughts, other than that in time Noah built an altar to the Lord, which had a profound effect on the covenant that has been established, God's covenant to protect, sustain, and restore the world and all who live in it. Over the past months, pastoral team has arranged 4 coffee breaks in which we've invited teachers, administrators, and staff of different schools to come together to share with each other and pastoral team about how they're feeling about their work. At our most recent coffee break, toward the end of January, 12 people representing public schools gathered together. It was eye-opening to learn more about the differences between city and county schools. It was remarkable to observe 2 librarians from different county schools connect with one another and share about the differences in their settings. And when experienced teachers shared about how they were adapting to new school settings, it was great to hear newer teachers name how valuable that part of the conversation was for them. Throughout our time together, there were honest reflections about the challenges in each school setting. And then, just before the conclusion of our time, one teacher said how much this time, this hour, was meaningful. But the next time pastoral team pulls this group together, we should start by inviting teachers to tell humorous stories, because there's so many stories that teachers could tell. At one point during the coffee break, Nathan Barge named that the time that we just spent together functioned as a call to prayer for each other. And at another point, I greatly appreciated hearing both Cindy Lamb and Betty Simonson reflect on how glad they are that they've had the opportunity to dedicate their lives to teaching. Pastoral team is currently making arrangements for similar gatherings in March with other subsets of our congregation. For instance, those working in the medical and social services fields. And there are other groups that we plan to connect with later, including those working for nonprofits, stay-at-home parents, and business owners, to name a few. So look for information about upcoming coffee breaks. But you know what? It's a bit misleading. We haven't yet served coffee. Pastoral team values these opportunities to hear about all that has been leading up to each person's everyday ministry. Mark's version in the Gospel of Mark, Mark's version about Jesus' time in the wilderness is, well, there's really no other way to say it. It's very, very stark. The version provides none of the details that Matthew or Luke offer. No reported conversation with his adversary, no Temple Mount, no suggested stones to loaves miracle. Alone in the wilderness, it leads me to believe that Jesus, too, knew something about silence and loneliness. We are left to fill in the blanks for ourselves about the questions and thoughts in Jesus' head during those long days and nights. On Wednesday, we entered the season of Lent, and it'll last for 40 days. And during Lent, we'll remember Jesus' time in the wilderness. There is something that happens during Lent that causes us to enter into the same type of interior space that Jesus experienced. When all is stripped away through practices of self-denial, and when we set aside maybe more time for prayer and devotion, we find in the stillness all that we have avoided in our daily routine. We find that our frenetic busyness has hidden our deep anxiety, insecurity, and fearfulness. We encounter our helplessness in the midst of our own mistakes and the chaos of the world in which we live. It is not easy work to recognize all that has led up to this moment, or to face the claim that God has placed on your life or on mine. It can feel very lonely. But only insofar as we enter into this wilderness can we too experience the power of the one whose resurrection life makes each one of us new. For Patrice Cullors, it was the way her brother had been treated throughout his life that led her to be ready for action when overcome with overwhelming despair. From a young age, Monty, one of her older brothers, was harassed by police officers because of his 6-foot, 2-inch frame. In a book published last year titled When They Call You a Terrorist, A Black Lives Matter Memoir, Cullors describes how Monty was treated, stating, "I spent my childhood watching my brother get arrested. Once, when I was just 12, we were walking down the street, Monty and I, and a cop we saw regularly came up to us. 'Are you Monty Cullors?' he barked. 'Yes,' my brother responded. And that was it. In front of me, he handcuffed Monty and took him away. I had no idea what for. To this day, I have no idea what for. All I know is that it was a common occurrence, and not just for Monty. It's hard for me to think of a boy in my neighborhood who didn't spend time in juvenile hall, or who wasn't arrested at least once." Cullors' firsthand awareness of her brother's experiences was the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement she helped start in the summer of 2013. Along with Alicia Garza and Opal Tometi, Cullors had one goal in mind at the movement's inception: federal charges needed to be brought against Trayvon Martin's killer. Cullors' writing includes prescient observations about how her life had been leading up to this moment. She was prepared because she had come through all the devastation within her family's story. Until today, BLM is a decentralized network with no formal hierarchy, but over 30 chapters nationwide, all of which are mobilized to address racial inequality. The challenge of Lent is coming to terms with the fact that though devastation and isolation of wilderness are far from God's original intention for creation, it was through these terrible, harsh realities that God brought forth new life. Noah and Jesus had to face the question of how they understood their lived experiences. Throughout Lent, we must do the same. But before we become distraught, take note that the passages in focus this morning from Genesis and Mark are not centered either on the chaotic devastation of the flood, nor the adversary who threatens to undo us. Instead, these passages center around promise. God's promise to Noah and family: "I am setting my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you." And God's promise to Jesus: "You are my beloved son. With you I am well pleased." Over the next 40 days, I trust we'll focus not on the chaotic devastation around us, nor on the adversary who threatens to undo us. Instead, we'll focus on the promise and power of God, who created the world, called it good, and who has established a covenantal promise to protect, sustain, and restore the world and all who live in it. And I trust that we'll be freed up to begin to understand all that has been leading up to this moment in our lives. Before I conclude, I invite all of us to spend a moment taking in the Worship Arts installation. Maybe the striking visual helps you think about three significant parts of your life that have come together. Or maybe the colors themselves have meaning for you. Notice how life's events have led up to this moment. Throughout this Lent, these next days, I'll be thinking a lot about how, at times, I'm unable to close myself off from worrying until late into the night. How I haven't been the best of friends sometimes because I have a much easier time maintaining my commitments to people I see regularly than those who no longer live nearby, even if long-standing friendships are affected. And how I find that I'm most energized when researching and learning new methods and information. Those are three of the things that have led up to this moment in my life. Throughout Lent, I'll also consider how the kingdom of God is at hand in this community and the many ways that you are helping me and so many people that you're connected to believe in the good news of God's promise to protect, sustain, and restore the world and all who live in it. Amen.